Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Craig Kupstein, U.S. Navy intelligence officer, and Republicans Karen Sigmund, Gary Aminoff, and Karen Kenny, as well as Charles Moran. Our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to send us a tweet, you can send it to @btbdumont. Our program tonight coming to you from our studios at Westwood One Studios in beautiful Culver City, California. This is our last broadcast, at least for a while, from California. We've been out here since December, and again, we'll talk a little bit more about that as the program unfolds this evening. Lots to talk about, including the fight for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. That fight is happening in California. It's happening in states around the United States, as well as in Illinois, our home base. But again, the big story in the world at this moment, has been for quite some time now, is the missing Malaysian airliner with Boeing 777 with 239 people on board. It has been missing since March 8th. It is the mystery of the world at the moment. Craig Kupstein, who is a frequent guest on this program, and if you're a longtime listener, you know that name. He's a former U.S. Navy intelligence officer with great credentials, having served on the staff of Norman Schwarzkopf. He joins us from his home in Chicagoland. Craig, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here, Bruce.
Of all the things that you know and you have read about since March 8th and this incident, what is the most suspicious thing to you as a former Navy intelligence officer?
Well, probably it doesn't even concern the plane. It concerns the response of all the parties with respect to the loss of the plane. That plane flew through a number of air defense identification zones of Malaysia, of Thailand, possibly of Indonesia, possibly of India, and set off no alarms, had nobody come to challenge it, and the threat potential there bodes not well for the future. For example, if China decides to expand, what's left? I mean, if nobody is going to challenge them, and the ADIZs, as they're called in the business, ADIZs, if they don't mean anything, wow, that's very scary stuff.
One of the things that we have learned thus far is that it appears that someone on that plane disabled the tracking devices. How easy is it to do that?
Well, it's not too easy because one of them is mounted underneath the pilot's cockpit. So you've actually got to get up through a trapdoor, go in through a door in the lower level of the plane. It's very difficult to get that one off. You can switch off two of the others up in the cockpit, but that one that kept pinging for like 7 hours, it didn't send data, but it said, I'm here, I'm alive, the plane's still flying. So we know it was in the air. Our original report said that that plane was flying with about 3 or 4, maybe 5 hours of fuel left on board. At the time it was last noted in the air, that was about 2:30, I believe. But that's not true. It had to have enough fuel to get to Beijing and then to a divert airport beyond Beijing. So probably another hour of fuel beyond that. And if we draw a radius from Kuala Lumpur, that plane could be in the Philippines right now, which has a interesting uprising in some of the southern islands, although the Philippines would have us believe it's no longer an uprising. It could be out to Sri Lanka. It could be out to Afghanistan. It could even be touching Iran.
Is it true that the area that we're dealing with now is one of the most complex and most sort of remote areas of the entire world, the Indian Ocean?
I'm not sure I would call it complex. I would call it pretty simplistic by contrast with, say, the Northern Hemisphere. But I would call it very remote. Very unusual. In fact, I've driven the whole length of that Malay Peninsula. I've sailed in the Strait of Malacca. I've flown many, many Navy missions throughout the Indian Ocean.
What should we read from the way in which the United States and the United States Navy have responded? There have been reports about certain types of vessels and ships going in, taking part of this international rescue effort. How do you read that as a Navy man?
Here's how I read it. I read it that we had best get our data from our own satellites, because what we got initially from Malaysia was really just so wrong, it was unbelievable. They had us believe that the plane was down in the Gulf of Thailand. Then they said it was down in the Andaman Sea, and that was the last known point. But quite frankly, ships have a certain visibility. They can't see too far. If they have a helicopter that can get up higher, they can see more. But the best sources we have are the new P-8 Poseidon aircraft, which is a 737 airframe, and, you know, reconfigured for the Navy with all kinds of great stuff in it, and the P-3 aircraft. But they come from Diego Garcia, perhaps, the island of Masira off the coast of Oman, and probably from, let's see, they could come out of Guam, or they could come out of parts of Japan.
Is this search hampered because of the countries that are involved, although their hearts may be in the right place and their intentions may be good? There are certain things they just don't want to share with other nations.
Absolutely. There's also certain things that shouldn't be shared with other nations, the reason being that we don't want to give away all of our technology, all of our knowledge, all of our ability to solve difficult equations to miscreants, people who would do ill to both us and the rest of the West. But if that plane, Bruce, was ever taken by somebody, well, let's say that it was a Islamic terrorist group, and I'm not saying it was, but if it was, the targets, if the plane could be repainted and its communications gear refixed so that the comms gear would simulate another plane from another airline, many of the big cities in the West could be a target of that plane, and so could a place like, and I know nobody would ever say, how'd you come up with this, but a place like Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. A lot of the Islamic militants are very unhappy with the king of Saudi Arabia, and they would love to get their hands on the two holiest sites in all of Islam. Jerusalem wouldn't be a target, but Tel Aviv could certainly be a target. London, yeah. Paris.
Now, you're going down a road that suggests terrorism. Do you think that it's, given the number of days that have passed, do you think that all of the evidence is leading in that direction? Is this something, this is much more than a simple missing plane that has crashed somewhere. Is that your professional assessment at this time?
Yes, it is, Bruce. I don't think one person, let's say one of the pilots, decided to pull off a fast thing and maybe shoot the other pilot, take over the plane. I don't think one pilot could silence everybody. For example, that plane went to 45,000 feet. The question is, why did it do that? It's above its service ceiling. It could stall out at that level. Luckily for them, they didn't. But what happened to the people at that point? Mm-hmm. Also, the strange part is that all the cell phones still were answerable, but nobody answered.
Greg, we're going to have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. If you're listening coast to coast, you probably have a thought, a question, or maybe even an opinion about what happened to the missing Malaysian airliner. 1-800-723-8289. Craig Capstein will remain with us for another segment. We also have in-studio guests here in California. They, too, will weigh in when we roll on from Culver City, California. Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking to Craig Capstein, United States Navy retired, a member, a former intelligence officer. He also served all over the world in various capacities with the United States military, including the staff of General Norman Schwarzkopf during Operation Desert Storm. Craig, back to the suspects in this particular case. A lot of focus has gone on the pilots, the pilot, the co-pilot. The pilot allegedly had, in a blog, had been part of an opposition, at least his blog suggested that he was opposed to the current regime in Malaysia. And so because of that, there's maybe some suspect there, but there isn't anything overtly that's glaring in any of the backgrounds of either the pilot or the co-pilot that would suggest that they are involved in any other aspect of any radical thought at this particular time. So I guess and the other element of the story that came out is that to determine who the 239 people were, we knew early on that two of those passports had been stolen. Is there anything more that you can tell us or surmise based on sort of the passports and who the people are and how cooperative nations are in this international investigation to identify the nationals that are on that plane from their respective countries?
Well, surprisingly, we could probably get more help from China than anybody else. They had so many of their nationals on that plane. We only had one adult and two very small children, yet we are the lead in the investigation. It's because we have the capability, the talent, and the past experience. I think the pilot has survived many, many, probably different administrations there in his country. That country and Thailand, the one just to the north of it, have gone through just governments like you can't believe. You could count them like cards in a deck of cards. And I think the pilot's shown himself to be pretty resilient. He's gone through no matter what his political background is. Mm. I had that noted to me, by the way, by somebody, and I didn't think that was a key thing.
Mm-hmm. Also, let me just interject for a moment. In the studio, we have Karen Sigmund. She is the founder and director of an activist organization called Rage Against the Media. We'll be talking about her area of expertise a little bit later on in the broadcast. Gary Aminoff, also a longtime Republican leader in Los Angeles and California, joins us. And Dr. Karen Kenny is here. She is founder of the San Fernando Valley Patriots. She's also a psychotherapist in real life. But they have been listening to your comments, and obviously even before the broadcast began, know that this is really the hot topic in the world to be discussed. And Karen Sigmund, you were making a point that there was a question about how long they could survive when the plane was at 42,000 feet.
Right.
Do we know how long they flew at that level? And what was your experience when you flew at a level very similar to that?
Well, right.
Let Karen respond to that, and then I want to go back to you, Craig.
Right. When I heard that they had flown at least for some amount of time at 45,000 feet, I remembered an experience I had had about 10 years ago on a 767 that was at 41,000 feet, passing out. And the flight attendant said that actually that it wasn't all that unusual for that to happen. So 41,000 seems already beyond what some of us can tolerate, even for approved commercial travel, and 45,000 feet for this plane that isn't even approved for that level. Just wondering how long can people survive, and when do the masks come down, and for how long?
Greg?
Aaron, the mask could have dropped down, but if you don't turn on the oxygen, even though the mask dropped down, your lifespan is going to be about 1 minute. You're going to be unconscious in about 15 to 20 seconds.
So would it be your speculation, and I want to stress to those listening around the country, this is speculation. Now, we are talking with a former Army, or Navy rather, intelligence officer. But if indeed there is a bigger plot here, it seems to me that those 239 people are clearly expendable.
Hmm.
That there's no reason, unless there's some assistance that they're getting from some of those people. Does everyone agree with that? Dr. Kenny, do you agree with that? That the people are expendable at this particular moment?
I think for such a group, if there is a terrorist root behind this, I think, yes, these would be collateral damages. And as we talked off the air, it's like that movie Hunt for Red October. How do you get the innocent people off of the submarine you're trying to steal? And it's either they die or you get them off. It seems easier that these would be unwitting and unwilling, if you will, casualties. And there has been no record of landing. So I wanted to ask you, sir, as an expert, everyone is going to a political reason for this particular kind of hijacking, piracy, whatever term you want to use. Could there be another, perhaps technological or religious or other reason for it, other than strictly political?
Well, Islamic militants, you could call it religious, but it's still political. I would call it that. I don't see any of the other countries playing a game. other than possibly Iran or North Korea. But the one ace up the sleeve, the question remains, Russia has a big vote today in the Ukraine. And who's to say that if you want to look for conspiracy theories, and this is only one, who's to say the KGB didn't work with somebody who they knew was planning on doing something to obfuscate their situation there in the Crimea and provide a different situation that takes the world's focus off the Crimea? I'm not saying that happened, but I'm saying it's one of those things in the back murky depths.
Gary Aminoff also joins us. Gary, you and your colleagues, when this discussion has been, I'm sure there's been some questions that you've had with your friends on this. What do you find curious and most suspicious about this?
Well, I suspected from the beginning that it was some kind of hijacking of the plane. I'm curious why Malaysia did not check the passports with Interpol, which I understand is customary and part of the routine. Apparently they didn't do that in this case, and whether those two Iranians with fake passports might have had anything to do with it.
Did you ever hear the term bakshish?
Yes.
It really means that if you cross somebody's palm with a little bit of green or whatever the currency of the day is, they look the other way. Mm-hmm. It's probably pretty typically done, and when you're talking about millions of passports lost every year, some countries just don't take the time to check them. They aren't as thorough as, let's say, England or France or the United States.
But the largest, as you said before, the largest number of passengers on this plane are Chinese.
Right.
Do you find that unusual? In other words, is there some message that's going back to China about this loss of plane?
China has somewhat of an Islamic uprising in its northwest province, what we used to call Xinjiang province. I believe that's the way it was pronounced. It's where some of their special warfare and nuclear capability has been developed. Those people want an independent country. They want an Islamic Republic. And they are the ones that, I think it was in Kunming, took knives and slashed and killed more than 20 people just in the last several weeks. So they're coming on the radar screen, but I don't see them as having the technical capability to do what was done with this aircraft.
Do you see this as something that goes beyond a small band of dedicated radicals?
Very definitely.
That this has the fingerprints of a state-sponsored supporter somewhere?
Probably Al-Qaeda or some of its minions that they support and develop and work with. A lot of this is interconnected. It's almost like looking at the old our West or looking at the old Warsaw Pact countries. These are some of the Islamic countries. By no means all the Islamic countries, nor am I trying to indict the religion. I'm not in the least. But there are many, 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 many unemployed, unemployable, uneducated young men around this part of the world who are looking for a job. And what's the job? Who knows? I don't know.
Kenny's got a comment.
You mentioned something earlier. Do you believe that there is, if you will, conspiracy, a state-sponsored terrorism, that there's got to be people on the ground, and it seems to me that would help with this landing of the plane. It seems to me that you need the plane for reasons that we don't know. So if it is not, as you say, to do something nefarious, another terrorist act, how would this plane land without it being picked up?
Okay, well, here's the issue. There are about 600 airfields, old ones, new ones, long runway ones. There's still airfields left over. I mean, if you work on them for a year or something in the planning of an action such as this one, you could make one of those old airfields usable for a landing. And if you land the plane before it's out of fuel, you've got a plane there. If you have painting facilities, you could repaint the plane. It could be used as a delivery device. And I hate to say this because it will scare people, and I'm not trying to scare them, but this is the worst-case scenario. And if you're giving a briefing to a theater commander, you always say, if this plane is taken and it's flyable and they still have a pilot that can take it off and they have people that can work on the plane, repaint it, reconfigure it in terms of communications, you have a delivery device that could deliver nuclear, biological, or chemical weaponry, and that's not a good thing.
I spoke to a pilot yesterday at the airport, and he mentioned to me that because of all these landing fields that were left over from World War II, he said that the ability to land a 21st century jet with its power and its weight is probably something that is doable, but taking off is the great challenge.
Exactly. I mean, it would be a very difficult feat, and I'd say out of those 600, you might have 10 or 20 airfields.
Craig, we have to say farewell to you. Craig Kopstein has joined us, former United States Navy intelligence officer. He joins us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. When we come back, we'll switch gears and we'll talk about the future of the Republican Party. We've got three experts here from the great Golden State. They will share their thoughts and opinions, and our phone lines will remain open for you to cast your ballot on the future of the Republican Party. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Sandusky, Ohio to Sacramento, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. And around the table with us right now, we welcome three guests. You heard briefly from them in the last segment. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, and we begin with, they're all Republicans. They're all interested in the future of the Republican Party, where it goes nationally, not exclusively in the state of California. So if you're listening around the country and you are a Republican and are concerned about the future of that party and what it might look like and some of the players that are on the scene, this will be an opportunity for you to call in and share your thoughts and opinions. But Karen Sigmund, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a PhD. Nice to have you with us tonight. And we got a couple of Karens tonight, both PhDs. But tell us about your background.
Great to be here. yes, I am founder director of an organization called Rage Against the Media, where we fight against the corrupt, biased, dishonest, depraved mainstream media. Which somebody's got to fight against them, so that's us. I'm also the former president of the Pacific Palisades Republican Club, so I've been playing a role in Republican Party issues here in California for some time, and that's really, that's where my heart is, making sure that Republicans prevail because our ideas are the right ones.
And our other Karen tonight is Karen Kenny. She also is a PhD. A little bit about your background, doctor.
Mine's in clinical psychology. I specialize in post-traumatic stress disorder, work with a lot of children and soldiers. But for tonight's purposes, I am founder of the San Fernando Valley Patriots, and we are loosely affiliated with the Tea Party. And I became a YouTube queen, so to speak, when I got to testify regarding the IRS scandal in Washington, D.C. on June 4th with an extraordinary panel of
kind of stole the show.
It was an honor to be there.
And you're a recovering journalist.
I know, but print media, so it takes longer.
Gary Eminoff also joins us, a long list of honorary activity that you've been involved in, and participatory as well as honorary. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I have been involved in conservative causes for many years. I started getting involved in party politics in the after 9/11. I founded the San Fernando Valley Republican Club and have been involved on the executive board of the Republican Party of LA County and the executive committee of the California Republican Party. So I guess I would call myself a Republican activist.
A question to those Republicans, or an answer for those Republicans listening around the country. There's been so much said and written that the Republican Party has turned its back on Hispanics and the growing power of the Hispanic voter. That is traced back to the state of California and the way in which the California Republican Party has dealt with Hispanics versus the way the Texas Republican Party has dealt with Hispanics. They're two different states, same party, but each of them has a far different following of Hispanic voters. One, Texas, very respectable, and it certainly helped elect and reelect George Bush and propelled him to the White House in 2000. And yet there is the legacy of what's happened in the state of California. So on that very focused issue, Gary, what does the party in the state of California have to do to send a signal to the Republican Party around the country that the Republican Party can be, in fact, perhaps is, opening and welcoming to Hispanics.
Well, the the California Republican Party has always been open and welcoming to Hispanics. We have an organization called the Republican National Hispanic Assembly, very active. We have two chapters in L.A. County. We have an organization called Grow Elect, in which we are seeking out Hispanic candidates. I happen to be the campaign chairman in this cycle of a Hispanic who is running for Congress against Brad Sherman. We welcome, we support, and we want more involvement of Hispanics in our party.
Karen Kenny, that's not the image that the party has nationally, though. What's wrong? Is there a disconnect between what you're doing and what message is being sent and what message is being heard by Hispanics?
I think so. I come from the Tea Party conservative constitutional part of the GOP, and there's an umbrella there. In my group, I look around and I see, in my monthly meetings, blacks, Hispanics, people from the Balkan countries, former communist countries, Central Europe. We have people from Poland, Czechoslovakia. And I think this is an odd form of racism we're talking about. Hispanics versus Asians versus blacks versus women versus all that. And so for me, I personally believe, let's show them our values. Some of the cultural values of these groups are, oddly enough, let's climb the ladder of economic success and let's have middle class lifestyles. Let's appeal economically. Let's also appeal to your values as families, as people that want to contribute rather than be put dumbed down and in diapers. My belief is that this form of racism is the conservatives and GOP speaking progressive language, gender, race, and class. I think they lower the bar if they say, if you have American principles and values, come join us. If you speak Spanish, come join us. I don't care about that. I don't care. I care about your character. Let's borrow. If we're going to borrow something, let's borrow from Martin Luther King, and let's broaden it and beef it up and draw people that way, not according to nationality, ethnicity, or race. That's
Karen Sigmund, how do you answer the same question?
So eloquent. My goodness.
Top that.
I don't know that I can. I could not agree more, but really, incredibly eloquent. I do agree that there is this false divisiveness that's going on, pitting one group against another group. The American values are what should and does draw people to us. The Republican Party is the power that is the party that empowers, not infantilizes. To dumb down, as Dr. Karen Kenny said, is exactly wrong. We are the party that does empower, that opens opportunity to everybody, that has the values that most of these, that any individual of any race, gender, you know, any kind of
then
division
why
you want
is,
to talk
why
about.
Why is that you've each made the very strong case? Why is that message not being heard? I mean, if that's the message you believe that you're sending out,
right,
that doesn't appear to be the message that is being heard by the Hispanic community. Now, are they ignorant of the fact? Are they being wooed and seduced by the Democrats?
Yes.
Are you being out-campaigned? What's the story, Gary?
We are being lied about. The Democrats, we've allowed the Democrats to characterize us, to frame who we are, and we haven't countered that.
Mm-hmm.
And as the Republican Party has always stood for freedom. We were founded on the basis of freedom and liberty, and that's what we stand for. And anybody of whatever ethnicity who wants to support the cause of liberty will stand with us.
Now, you were having a Republican primary for governor. Tim Donnelly, who's a member of the Assembly, was a guest on this program several weeks ago when we were out here. Neil Kashkari is also a former Treasury Department executive. The two of them appeared yesterday at the California Convention in Sacramento. They each had some outreach. We'll have an update from someone who was at that convention who will be joining us, Charles Moran, shortly after the hour. But when you look at that race, is that a race that's going to determine the future of the party, or is this just a one-election race? And tell us a little bit about the candidates, and where do you come down in that race? Is one candidate clearly well ahead of the other, in your opinion?
I shorthand it, TARP or Tim, because Neil helped formulate the TARP bailout.
Neil Kashkari.
Yes, you pronounce his name far better than I do. Okay. And I'm sure he's a decent man. I've heard about him. I've read about him. However, I have met and I do know Assemblyman Donnelly. He has spoken to our group without a teleprompter, I might add. And he also is extraordinary. Donnelly is extraordinarily keen on three Tea Party principles. And whether Tea Party is a label, we can argue. But the fact is, fiscal responsibility, constitutionally limited government, and free market principles are part of the general GOP platform. They should be. I don't know that they're platform, excuse me. Mm-hmm. But as far as Donnelly goes, I think people are going to underestimate him, which will be an advantage. And I think people, trust me, what Gary said is accurate. It's not about branding or labeling. It's about, are you whispering in a hurricane? And as a former media person, our group, we've had 85 events. The press has come out and covered three, including a fundraiser for a food bank, and they came out and covered three. Access to the media is difficult, but the messaging needs to be done more heartfelt.
Well, what about, we talked about the perception of the party. Let's talk about the perception of the Tea Party.
Right.
And how accurate is it? Because the perception that when you hear Democrats talking about it, you know, they're not very smart. They may be racist because in some of the early public displays of their fervor, there were some signs that perhaps should not have been carried, and that's now part of the, you know, that's part of the Google record.
Well, it's such a great point. And then talking about Tim Donnelly and how we deal with Hispanics and messaging generally, this is what the media does. It's not only the Democratic Party who lies about us, but the media will vilify the Tea Party, everything that the Republicans do, how we message about Hispanics, absolutely everything, including the signage at those early Tea Parties. That's all the media is lying.
I want to follow up on that 1-800-723-8029 about the media's role in defining the Republican Party and how, if at all possible, can that be changed? I'm Bruce Dumont from Culver City, California. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City, California. Let's go to call. Charlotte is listening to us out of Chicago on WLS. Go ahead, Charlotte.
Hi. In regard to media or press bias, Cheryl Atkinson, why did she resign from CBS? She's a veteran, prize-winning investigative reporter, been hard on Republicans and Democrats. And why was her computer hacked?
One of our Dr. Karens, Karen Sigman, respond.
Cheryl Atkinson, people over the last year or so would ask if there are really no good investigative journalists in the mainstream media, and I'd say absolutely. There's the one. There's Cheryl Atkinson, who reported on Fast and Furious, who was the only one who reported about Benghazi, who really was the only dogged reporter on so many of these issues. To me, over the last, like I said, years, what surprised me is that she was still there. I am not at all surprised to hear that she left. I don't know how she stood it. She was the only one to pierce the liberal echo chamber bubble that is the mainstream media. Hats off to her for staying in as long as she did. I do not blame her one tiny bit for leaving, but the problem is now there are none. Now there is no investigative journalist we can really point to and say this is the one who's doing the reporting that needs to be done. She's gone.
What about, thank you for your call. What about, now obviously we're talking, she was referring to the big three network organizations. Mm-hmm. which have less power today than they did 10 years ago, certainly less power than they did 20 years ago, because with the growth of certainly MSNBC and Fox News and to some extent CNN, although they're looking for a new brand at the moment, could one argue that at this moment in time, because of the success of Fox News, and Fox News is immensely successful, certainly compared to the competition in the cable industry,
right,
that if you're a conservative, you really can get the news the way you want, when you want it. And it's called Fox News.
Right.
So there isn't anything that's being hidden from you. If you're being told your definition of the truth. And again, it maybe is not out there every single day with the power of CBS. And again, people still get their news from CBS, NBC, and ABC considerably
exactly.
more than cable. Although cable sort of steals the show insofar as they're the opinion makers are still watching the cable channels.
Correct, except they really are still watching the networks, and even not watching the networks, they still go to their Facebook pages, to their websites, they still get their news from MSNBC or NBC.com. They still have more power than we think, and most of our friends and neighbors who believe they know what's going on get that information from these major networks. It's us who watches Fox, and why is it that it's only us? Because Fox is vilified by all the rest, including the president, who tells his people, and I hear now airports are told they shouldn't have their stations set to Fox News, but CNN. There's a lot of control going on here about what news is promulgated and what isn't.
Gary, how do you beat that? When you're trying to put, you're part of a group, everyone at this table is part of a group that wants to make the Republican Party relevant in a state where the elections for president were contested. They haven't been contested here for decades. So the question is, looking at the landscape, looking at the media that you believe is against you, I assume you agree with what Dr. Karen just had to say, how do you run up that hill? How do you carry the water up that hill? And the passion you have is still there, but do you see light at the end of the tunnel?
Definitely see light at the end of the tunnel.
What is it?
If you look at the statistics, older people, and I don't mean that pejoratively, but people 50 and over still get most of their news from the network news, the 11 o'clock news or the 6 mm-hmm. o'clock or 7 o'clock news. But people younger than that are no longer looking to the alphabet media to get their news. They're reading blogs. They're looking to new media to get their information. A lot of people get their news from Facebook or Twitter. So as people get more, as the population ages, more and more people will be getting their news from other sources that are more accurate than the network
stations. But what do you believe, Dr. Kenny, what is it about the Republican message or the Republican brand or the Tea Party brand? What do you think that attracts them to that? Because one thing that Rand Paul said at the CPAC convention, and you were at the CPAC convention, were you not?
Oh, blessings, no. But I wish I were.
Oh, you were at the CPAC convention.
Yes. The other Karen.
The question there is, of those that you saw, who received the biggest round of applause? We know that Rand Paul almost doubled the competition. 31% of the straw poll voted for him. I think second place was 11% with Ted Cruz.
Right, absolutely. It is the young people, as Gary was saying. The young people are getting news from elsewhere. I would also add to that list, though, Jon Stewart is one of the major mm-hmm. news sources, which is a little bit scary, but that is where a lot of our youth are getting their news. On the other hand, the light is that a lot of them are turning out for the message of liberty and freedom that Rand Paul is particularly eloquent about. So that's very heartening.
I want to know more about the CPAC. I want to get your report about CPAC. And also, we're going to be joined in the next hour by Charles Moran, who was just in from Sacramento. He was at the California State Convention. We'll get a report about what happened up there. But primarily, it's in context to what's happening to the Republican Party nationally. Again, everyone, I think, would agree at this table that right at this moment in time, it looks like Hillary Clinton is sailing to the Democratic Convention. But once upon a time before she was sailing to the Democratic Convention and something happened, we'll find out whether there's any likelihood of her being derailed in any way. And most importantly, for the next hour, who on the Republican horizon, who is most likely to be the person that can stop her from moving back into the White House? 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Let's get a plebiscite going. Who is the Republican nominee best positioned to keep Hillary Clinton from returning to the White House in 2016? I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8289, live every Sunday night, coast to coast and border to border tonight from Culver City, California. Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary in this hour by Republicans Charles Moran, Karen Sigmund, Gary Aminoff, and Karen Kenny. Our program phone lines open 1-800, toll-free, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Coming to you from our home at the Westwood One Studios in Culver City, California this evening. Our email address, btb@museum.tv. Website, beyondthebeltway.com, if you want to hear the podcast of this broadcast. And also, if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's at btbdumont, at btbdumont. In this hour, we're going to be talking about the future of the Republican Party. I asked before the break, is it inevitable that Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic nominee? Anyone who disagrees with that in this studio say, I don't think she's going to do it. Okay, nobody disagrees with
that. I don't think she's going to do it.
You don't think she's going to do it. You don't think she's going to run, or you don't think she's going to win the nomination?
I don't think she's going to run.
Why?
I just have... There's something I'm...
We should mention this is the psychoanalyst that's...
No. I'm a trauma therapist.
Okay.
I wish she would come out and explain her missing in action after she fainted. And I think there may be some... This is my conspiracy theory. There may be a health condition that we don't know about. I don't know if it's going to be like John F. Kennedy's Addison's disease. But I think the fact that nothing has been said about that... She disappeared for days after she fainted months ago, and that's my thought.
Right at the time she was going to testify about right. Benghazi, and that it was.
Yeah, there was that link, of course.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So you think there could be health? So you don't think she's going to run? Well, we will save for a future broadcast when we have all Democrats to figure out what would happen if that were the case. But for this discussion, I want to talk about the party and. You talked during the break, we talked about the importance of the message and the policy and the belief system that a candidate has. And yet the media and everyone else and the public, the voters, they gravitate maybe towards a person's positions, but they gravitate towards the personalities involved.
Mm-hmm.
You saw virtually all of them, not all of them, but you saw many of them when you went to the CPAC convention last
right.
week. We mentioned that Rand Paul sort of ran away with the straw poll.
Absolutely.
But what is your assessment of the candidates that you saw, the reaction that they had, and whether or not they were they hitting home runs to that group or were they hitting doubles?
I think it's really important to remember that CPAC is it caters to a very specific demographic. This is not a group that is representative of the Republican Party as a whole. And generally, they are very young. About half are in the very young age group. About half were registered there as students. This is a very young group that self-identifies as very conservative, not necessarily as Republicans. So that said,
But they get a lot of media attention.
Yes.
Now back to your concern about what the media, whether they can believed or not.
Right.
Does the national media give them too much credibility within the party?
I think that the national media will do whatever it can to destroy whoever we like the most. In a way, that's a sign. When they went after Sarah Palin a few years ago, that was a sign that she was hitting all the right notes.
Who do you think they're going after right now, Gary?
Well,
Rand Paul or Ted Cruz?
They're going after both of them.
Yeah.
They try to trash Ted Cruz whenever they can. Rand Paul hasn't been coming on as strong, so he doesn't get as much bad press, but they're going after him as well. And like Karen says, anybody that looks like they might be popular with Republicans will get the media treatment.
Charles Moran, do you agree with that assessment of the national media?
You know, I really think that there's been, ever since the government shut down, and I think that was brilliantly orchestrated, unfortunately, by John Boehner to show, I think, the extreme limits to which some of these candidates have just gone too far out of the boundaries. I think Ted Cruz, by going over that edge and shutting down the government, has absolutely damaged the Tea Party brand and helped the establishment Republican credibility, saying like, okay, we let them do this and they ran us right off the edge and we paid for it. So I think you're seeing a little bit of the blowback. Ted Cruz is having to take responsibility and Rand Paul is having to take responsibility for the impact that the government shutdown had on that wing of the movement.
Karen Kenny, do you agree with that?
Which part of it?
Well, the fact that that the Tea Party has been hurt because of the shutdown and because of the association that certainly Ted Cruz had in being the orchestrator of that.
I think the Tea Party has been hurt as soon as we formed from the shout heard around the world with Rick Santelli. I believe from the branding from Pelosi all the way up. And I don't know that Ted Cruz is responsible for shutting down. I must disagree with this very dear man who I just met. He's sitting to my right. Mm-hmm. I absolutely believe that the government shut down, by the way, during the storm, during the snowstorm. What made the media hound the government shutdown was the Obama administration's overreaction to, now let's draw your attention here, we'll put signs up, the veterans don't go there. Oh, we're cutting off this, your checks will be late here. I think that exacerbated what was a political tactic. We can argue how long it worked or how well it worked, but I think anybody now, I would hate to be in first place with the Republican Party because you're literally in the crosshairs with the general mainstream media, I believe.
Who is the Republican establishment within the field of candidates for 2016, Gary? Who's the establishment candidate or establishment candidates?
I don't know that I can answer that. I think it's a little bit early to be able to tell. Maybe some of my co-patriots here have a different idea, but I don't think the establishment has, the quote establishment, has really identified who they're going to back for 2016.
Well, what I'm hearing is not that the establishment has picked them, but people are saying that people like Chris Christie and Jeb Bush are the obvious establishment candidates, whether or not that's true, but that seems to be who the media has decided are our shoe-in establishment candidates and who are a lot of people are railing against.
One shoe-in doesn't seem to be a shoe-in anymore. I mean,
absolutely right. Earlier on, it was Chris Christie, and of course, now there's talk of his being, has he been redeemed in his, with his talk at CPAC and so on, but and I'm hearing his name still.
How was he, let's talk about that. The young firebrands that make up CPAC, how did they react to Chris Christie?
Not well, because again, I think he is perceived as an establishment choice. Then there is, of course, the fact that he has not come out very strongly with conservative principles on the whole. He was a one-trick pony as far as the union, teachers' unions went, but generally he does not voice conservative principles, which is one reason CPAC goers are not fans and one reason he is considered to be an establishment candidate, fairly or not. And I do think Christy Gate hurt him, and there we are. But I think I'm hearing Jeb Bush more and more.
When we come back, I want to get reaction from my audience and also the other guests here about Jeb Bush. Is this a situation where it's going to be somebody who comes literally out of, well, I want to say left field, out of maybe right field or moderate right field, short right field, to pick up the marbles in 2016? 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Culver City, California. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. We'll be back to conversation in just a moment after I mention a couple of things that Last week, or actually for the last several weeks on this program, you have heard commercials for the Houston Livestock and Rodeo Show, and I was invited down there to go to my first rodeo, and I will tell you, it is absolutely, it's the largest rodeo in the United States. And I went to Reliance Stadium in Houston the other evening. There were 70,000 people at the rodeo. You saw all of the rodeo contests, and then you saw Maroon 5 was there one night, and I saw Keith Urban the next night. But again, the operation that Leroy Schaefer's put together, he's had this job for 40 years. It is a mixture of entertainment and agriculture and education and Western heritage. It runs like a clockwork. I mean, he's got a substantial staff, and Kathy Cutiff and Bob Meehan and Susie Martin and James Davidson and Sarah Poole and Jason Kane. They make up sort of the brain trust of this organization. It is absolutely spectacular. And I will tell you, there's a lot of people from Houston, obviously a lot of people from Texas. But if you live around the country and you've never been to a rodeo, and you really want to jump in and get the feel of Texas and a region of the country and Western heritage, they hold it every March. It is absolutely spectacular. It's like a 3-day bath in sort of Western heritage, and I took that bath for at least two of the last 3 days, and it was spectacular. So to Leroy Schaefer and everybody down at the Houston Livestock and Rodeo Show, it was absolutely spectacular, and put it on your calendar for next year. Speaking of calendars for next year, we talked a little bit about CPAC, and you were just finishing up, because you were making the point about that Jeb Bush is growing as a name. So my question to you, I'm going to ask this one to you, Charles. Is the Bush brand too old?
I don't think the brand is too old. It's consistently being re-energized and reinvigorated, and you can see this by George P. Bush, who's running for Texas State Land Commissioner. You have the fourth generation of a Bush pursuing public office. And the durability of that name, the confidence that it lends, is something that is important to people. There is something, you know, like a Procter & Gamble or Tide or a Cadillac. There's something about a brand that you know and something that you trust.
What about younger people? What about younger voters?
Well, I think younger voters don't know Jeb Bush. I am familiar with the Bush family. Besides my role as a volunteer, in my professional world, I am a political fundraising consultant. The Bush family, I've worked for a number of them. Jeb had been a client of our firm's when he was running for governor. President George W. Bush, I had worked for, doing fundraising for. So I'm very aware of the Bush networks and how the time has been spent meticulously developing these relationships, and it's extremely important. Jeb is a different kind of Bush. He's not his brother. And in ways, that's, I think, you know, the traits that people want to see in a candidate now are something that Jeb has had. And maybe, you know, the time wasn't right for him to run for president before, but maybe the time is right for him now. He has a wife that is of Mexican descent. He speaks Spanish fluently. He has such a domestic focus. When he was governor of Florida, he just did amazing things for public education, for infrastructure development, really developing business. Things that we need a serious focus on that Barack Obama has royally destroyed.
What is he waiting for then? Because it seems to me that at this particular point, I mean, we have battles brewing between Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, and as I said on this program, and if you look at those first three primaries, in my opinion, the most likely winner of those first three primaries is Rand Paul.
Well, let's say this: if Jeb Bush gets in it, he's in it to win it. Jeb Bush doesn't need name ID. He, you know, it's whether or not he's going to pull the trigger and let the trains go down the tracks. A lot of people still don't really know a lot about Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. They know, you know, Ron Paul. They don't know Rand. These other candidates need exposure. They need donor networks to be created. They're really starting from scratch. Jeb doesn't do that. He flips a switch and it's on. And it's not a gentle ramp up. So what are you waiting for? You don't need to. These other candidates are starting early because they need to spool it up. Jeb doesn't need spooling.
But doesn't Rand Paul inherit a lot of that fervor of his father's campaign? I mean,
well, that's great if the presidential election is a CPAC straw poll, but that's not a presidential election, as we all well know. So,
do you take Rand Paul seriously, or are you more of a Ted Cruz person, Kathy?
Well, actually, I've never met either one. However, I take them both seriously in a very limited way. I don't think that right now the pool of GOP, if we're just talking candidates, and I think that's a narrow focus from where I sit, I'm more into principles. I wish the GOP was not the grand old party. I wish it was governed on principle. Thank you very much. However, I think Rand Paul is clearer about getting his principles out. I think Ted Cruz is clearer about getting principles out. I don't want to go into personality and politics right now because I think it's too soon. I just wish the GOP would have instead of putting a football team on the field, I wish we'd get behind some people and then put principled people around them.
But in a Republican primary, you've got to stand out. And the way that you traditionally have stood out, Gary, is you got to throw red meat out there. And people jump at that red meat. The people that are most active in the party, which again, at the moment, it may be it's either the Tea Party and those that believe in liberty and fiscal conservatism, or it is those that are in for the social issues. And again, we haven't talked about Rick Santorum, but I think Rick Santorum still hears, you know, Hail to the Chief when he wakes up in the morning, even though he may be the only one that hears it. But he's still flirting with the idea that he can do it. And a name that has not come up yet is Mike Huckabee. Mm-hmm. And was Mike Huckabee's name mentioned at all? He wasn't at the convention.
Yes, he was.
He was? Actually, oh, I thought he was not at the convention.
No, he was.
What was his reaction? What was the reaction to him?
That's a good question. I think
must not
he is
be spectacular.
Seen as sort of a past. He's done. It was my feeling.
Okay.
He's in the past.
If I were going to choose who I would want for president of the United States, it would not be Rand Paul, and it would not be Ted Cruz, and it would not be Rick Santorum, would not be Mike Huckabee. So
who would it be?
Well, I like Mike Pence a lot, governor of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
I like Bobby Jindal. There are conservatives out there who have proven themselves acting as governor. There are several Republican governors who would make good presidents.
Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm. Scott Walker. I like him. So those are the people that I like.
Who do you like?
You know, my doctor told me the other day that my cholesterol is a little high and to cut back on the red meat. So I want to see less of that. My dream team, if speaking just personally, would be Jeb Bush for president and John Huntsman for vice president. You've got a phenomenal mix of people with serious foreign policy background. With Huntsman, he can go around and be not an embarrassment like Joe Biden's been. He can actually get some respect. And the president, you know, a then president Jeb Bush.
Conservatives wouldn't buy him, though.
Conservatives won't buy him. But, you know, again, we've got so much damage to undo from the Obama-Biden days. We would absolutely need somebody, you know, we need a President Jeb Bush to focus on fixing our problems here and showing strong leadership and then sending a capable number two out around the world and reestablish America's preeminent position as the leader in the free world. You know, I think Jeb can articulate principled conservative values and then has a record of being able to try to show that. Again, it's getting this through. I don't just throw out the terms moderates and conservatives. I think you just have to articulate, again, what brings together individual responsibility, personal freedom, commitment to small government, less red meat, but let's find policies that accentuate that.
We have spoken for almost 15 minutes now about Republican candidates, and I'm now going to bring up the name Marco Rubio. And if we turn back the clock a year ago or 18 months ago, he was the guy to beat. What happened to Marco Rubio, and do you think Marco Rubio is toast?
Immigration Karen. Is what happened to Marco Rubio, unfortunately. I think he's dynamite. I think as a voice of conservative principles, I think he is absolutely outstanding. Do I want to see him as a candidate right now? Actually, I don't. I think I like him exactly where he is. I think he is a fabulous voice. He is extremely eloquent on most of the things that we hold dear. I think we need him exactly where he is.
But does his position on immigration which would make him perhaps a darling of the establishment. Is he the guy that's closest to be able to walk the line between the establishment and the Tea Party? Is there anybody out there that doesn't tip over one side or the other? Anybody?
Single-issue voting is the most dangerous thing that can happen in any political party. I love Marco Rubio, too. He is young, and he has a long political future in front of him. You know, he made the tough calls, and we need his voice in the Senate, and he needs to continue to be a young example to people in our party that you don't have to run. I mean, he will have a good career in the Senate and will do monumental things as he continues to mature, just like a good wine. And when the time presents itself, I think he will run for president, but he'll do so older and wiser and with a body of work behind him to run for the highest position in our country.
You say the same thing about Jindal?
Or
is Jindal ready now? Or do you think
ready now? I think Jindal's ready. People don't know Jindal, but I think he's ready. I totally agree with Charles that Marco Rubio, we need him to stay in the Senate, and I think he wants to. I don't think he intends to run for president. I like Jindal. I think he's ready. I think Scott Walker, who may be a little young, is also ready. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure he's going to run, but I like him.
When we come back, I want to ask you the question, and that is, with all of these names out there in the Republican Party, we've rattled off about 10 of them, and we haven't even named them all. Do they have a much stronger bench and a brighter future than the Democratic Party? Back shortly. From Grand Rapids, Michigan to West Hollywood, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. We've got people around the table, and let them introduce themselves right now. We start with Charles Moran, who literally just got off the plane from Sacramento, where he came in from the Republican convention up there.
Thank you. Charles Moran, resident in Los Angeles. I am a political fundraising consultant. I've been doing this for about 12 years, and I am 33 years old, so representing the younger spectrum. As a volunteer, I am the chairman of California Log Cabin Republicans, which is the nation's oldest and largest LGBT Republican conservative organization and their allies. That's what I do.
Karen Kenny.
Yes, I'm founder of the San Fernando Valley Patriots, a Tea Party group, and I'm also a psychotherapist in private practice specializing in post-traumatic stress disorders here in Los Angeles.
Gary Aminoff.
I'm a conservative activist involved in political campaigns and founded the San Fernando Valley Republican Club.
And you're also a blogger?
I am a blogger, yes.
Tell us about your blogs.
I blog at Bear to the Right and at Alliance for Liberty. Mm-hmm. And I also write articles for American Thinker and the Breitbart blogs.
And you're a commercial real estate executive.
I am a commercial real estate
executive. Beverly Hills, California.
Yes.
Commissions are high. Go ahead. Let's go. Karen Sigmund.
I am founder director of an activist organization called Rage Against the Media, and you can find us at rageagainstthemedia.org. I'm also the past president of the Pacific Palisades Republican Club. For about 8 years, I was an educator at various grade levels, including university, and for about 20, I was a scientist. So, but politics is my passion.
A personal note before we go back to calls. Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day in much of the nation. All the Irish of America will be celebrating tomorrow. And again, if you are at home tomorrow during the day and you watch the Queen Latifah show, the first guests are going to be the Dancing Rodriguez sisters. And the Dancing Rodriguez sisters, who are Irish dancers, are my granddaughters.
Oh.
And I was at the taping and met Queen Latifah this past week. It was a busy week for me. Queen Latifah on Monday and then off to Houston at the end of the week. Let's go to Grays Lake, Illinois, where JP is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think if the GOP stops nominating rhinos and starts nominating a conservative like Scott Walker, we'll take the White House. I don't even think Romney even wanted to win.
Who are the rhinos in the field that you think at this moment, JP? Name some names.
I haven't even dug into who's what at this point. All I know is that in the last two elections, we nominated McCain, who was hardcore in favor of amnesty, and we nominated Romney, who, Romney care says it all. But mm-hmm. after that, in August of 2012, he came out in favor of gay scoutmasters. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just not going to inspire the GOP base to turn out. And I think that was the real problem in the last two elections for the GOP. The base was turned off by the nominees. If we nominate a conservative Republican, and I think Scott Walker probably will fill the bill nicely, we'll be okay. But right now, I think we're going to see another rhino walk in. The conservatives will block each other in the primary process, run out of money, and then the only one left standing, like Romney, will be the rhino.
Thank you, Erica. The only rhino's name that I've heard mentioned here tonight is John Huntsman, who Charles would like as the vice president, and I don't think there's much chance of that happening. There wasn't much chance of him winning the Republican nomination, and I think it's less likely that somebody would pick him, even though he may have the credentials. But is there any other name that's out there that you would say is a rhino, a Republican in name only? I'm talking about at the national level.
I don't like to use the term rhino. My feeling is that anybody who runs under the Republican banner, by and large, believes in the key principles of freedom, fiscal responsibility, Constitution.
So Neel Kashkari running as governor of California, in your view, is not a rhino?
I'm saying I don't like to use the term. I'm not supporting okay. him. I'm supporting Tim Donnelly.
Okay.
I don't.
How was Tim Donnelly?
I love talking about money in politics, especially. And JP made the point that, you know, the conservatives are beating each other up and then running out of money. Newt Gingrich didn't run out of money when he had Sheldon Adelson bankrolling the super PAC. And Santorum didn't run out of money when Foster Freeze was bankrolling that super PAC. So, you know, again, the interplay of money in politics, and especially now with super PACs and a post-Citizens United world, the money will be there. But it's whether or not you can actually break out of the horse race that some of these candidates have just gotten themselves into and being typecast. It's great to be a staunch, solid conservative, but at some point or another, you've got to put together a willing coalition of people who are going to get you past 50% plus one in those primaries. Right. And you can't do that if you are just holding the ground in one part of the field. So it's not money. Don't blame it on that.
Let's talk about Paul Ryan for a second. Which is worse? That he ran for vice president on a losing ticket and didn't carry his home state, or the fact that he's a congressional Republican leader? Which is the biggest albatross around his neck, Dr. Kenny?
If we're looking at curtain number one, two, or three, I'd say curtain number one. I think that his fiscal bona fides are considerable. I think him to be a man of good character, and I think sadly, he was eclipsed by a damaged campaign and a wounded candidate. And I am not a political person as nearly as much as the people that are sitting around this table. However, I think that Ryan has a future, but not at the national level that way.
Tom, in Taylorville, Illinois, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Bruce. You know, the question I had is, there's a lot of talk about Jeb Bush, and he may be a fine fellow, but doesn't it bother anyone that we just, you know, with the Clintons and the Bush, we just keep reelecting the same people for decades at a time?
It bothers me.
Healthy for a public.
Tom, this is Karen Kenny from the San Fernando Valley Patriots. I agree with you. I think that the word dynasty regarding Bush and Clinton is becoming part of the personality politics that we get so much limited in. I would say if the persons, I don't care what their last name, I don't care if it's Smith, Brown, or Green, if they convey policies and principles, then you have a broader audience to draw from. But I think it's kind of stereotypical to just say just because their last name is Bush or just because their last name is Clinton. That's the personality politics that the media right. puts us in, and I think it's a mistake. I would rather want to get into someone's mind and heart and soul rather than just what's their last name.
I think also, because we mentioned now almost a dozen Republican candidates, potential candidates for President of the United States, and we've talked about the inevitability, with the exception of you, Dr. Kenny, the inevitability of Hillary Clinton being the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that when we get into the domination of what will happen during a primary season, the Democrats, if they don't have a competition, and it doesn't look like they're going to have a serious competition to Hillary Clinton if she decides to run, they're going to be shut out, notwithstanding the fact that the media may favor Hillary Clinton, and they do. But they're going to be somewhat shut out of the media window because there's going to be no there. There's going to be no story there. The story is going to be in the Republican side. And when you look at why she lost the nomination, you know, 7 years ago, her opponent was talking about newness and freshness and change and change and change and change. She is not a change agent. There's no way that she is a change agent.
Right.
And so it seems to me that the Democratic Party is somewhat saddled with a brand that's it's tried, it's true, but it's old and slow, and it's been, you know, marketed once before, and now they're going to try to spin it a new way. And yet on the other side, you're going to have a series of potential Republican candidates in a primary that are going to be shaking things up, and you're going to be having, whether it's Rand Paul talking about maybe, you know, decriminalizing marijuana, or maybe that's going too far, but at least having a more libertarian perspective on you know, on drugs and on gay marriage and on other issues. You're going to have one party that's going to look like they have all of the ideas against a candidate who isn't going to have anything new to say.
Exactly.
That's accurate.
Yeah. But that becomes a media problem for the Democrats,
right.
I would think.
But,
and you usually are cheering that the Republicans have a media problem, but would you agree that Hillary could have a media problem because of all this perception stuff, and she's also playing to a generation that doesn't even remember her husband?
I think this plays into so much of the hypocrisy that is a hallmark of the Democrat Party. They talk all the time about being the voice of young people, of fresh ideas, and we've got Jerry Brown again. Case after case after case, we have candidates from the Democrat Party who have been in Washington for decades and decades. Henry Waxman finally retiring. How long has he been there? 30 years? 40 years? So they talk as if they are the party of new ideas, of progressivism, and yet, just like her, they are actually career politicians who have been there forever, have not one single new idea.
Charles? I want to jump into this. I think so much of this stuff with Hillary Clinton is just manufactured. It's a political hack and somebody who gets paid to do this type of stuff. You know, all these super PACs and Ready for Hillary and, you know, all Priorities USA. This is keeping a lot of people employed. That's what this really is. It's about keeping political staffers who don't want to go back down and work on hard congressional races, keeping them in the limelight, and they are hoping that Hillary pulls that trigger, because if you know they are raising a lot of money to keep themselves paid now that the 2012 campaign is over, and there are candidates like Brian Schweitzer, Martin O'Malley, Andrew Cuomo, Kristen Gillibrand, even Joe Biden himself, who are serious Democratic contenders who could quite easily step into that role.
We've got a break. 1-800-723-8289 from Culver City. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. We'll go to calls in just a moment, but I did not want to run out of time at the end of the broadcast to thank some very special people. I mentioned that we've been doing our broadcast here since early January for most Sunday nights. This is our last broadcast. We'll be back here probably in late April. But again, I want to give special thanks to David Felker at Westwood One for helping set everything up out here. And also we've had a great team, Ted Woods and Corey Irwin. And tonight James Smith is giving us a hand. Of course, Tom Veracruz back in Chicago that's been working with all these guys to make sure that we get on the air every Sunday night. And again, really special job. They've made me feel very comfortable at my new West Coast home, and I don't know how often I'm going to visit, but it's great to be back in California, and always great to be surrounded by professional broadcasters, and also a lot of great guests, meeting a lot of new people who are involved in politics all over the country. Let's go to Champaign, Illinois. Joe is listening to us on line 6. Joe, you probably don't know you're on line 6, but go ahead with your question.
Thank you. The Republican Party wants to give the mainstream news vermin absolute ecstasy, all they need to do is run Jeb Bush, because he may be a wonderful man and he may be a good political guy, but he would get trounced because there'd be more than 4 million Tea Party people would sit at home and not vote again like they did in 2012. And in my opinion, there's one ticket that could trounce Hillary Clinton, and that would be Dr. Ben Carson as president, Marco Rubio as vice president.
All right, let's let our Tea Party people respond. First of all, do you think that if Bush was the nominee, do you think a lot of Tea Party people would sit at home? Karen.
This is where name recognition would hurt without principles coming out strongly and firmly. I think, yes, it would hurt him. I think Tea Party people are at risk of staying home.
Do you agree with that, Karen?
I think it is quite likely, but I think at some point, and I don't know what that point is, we have to decide that any Republican is better than any Democrat that's out there.
That's always the fallback position.
That just always. Absolutely is, and shame on us if people stay home.
Gary?
I think if Jeb Bush is going to run, he's going to have to early on articulate the distinction between him and his brother. Otherwise, there's going to be the problems.
That's really tough. Yeah. And what about Ben Carson? Is he a serious candidate?
I don't believe so. I think Ben Carson is a fantastic speaker. I think he's got great ideas. I don't think he's shown that he has presidential, that he's knowledgeable enough to be president of the
He could
United
be the
States.
Herman Cain of 2016.
Mm. Yeah.
Let us go to Crete, Illinois. John is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio, the radio home of Dan Proft. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, Bruce. George Washington founded this country. They say he's Christian, some say Catholic. But he said religion and morality are indispensable for this country. What we've descended to, the Republican Party, I heard callers saying, forget about the moral issues like being good anti-abortion, being good anti-homosexuality. Concern yourself about business. So that's completely some kind of George Washington founded a good revolution that was successful, and now we have an untalked-about revolution that forget about Washington and the founding of this country and concern yourself about the temporary. And also you mentioned Queen Latifah and your granddaughter.
Yep.
Oh, well, God bless you. Queen Latifah was on PBS, one of these shows, and she performed a lesbian wedding. So I think lesbian is wrong, and CBS hijacked the Emmy show, whatever it was, and that was wrong. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, that subject did not come up during the Irish dance session on the show. Question to you, Dr. Kenny, and that is, when Tea Party people get together, do they talk about moral issues?
Yes. And in this climate, it's difficult. If I had my druthers, I would say to any political party, learn the difference between vice and virtue, not in a social issues way. That's left between you and God and in your own conscience. That's my personal belief. What the Tea Party people that I speak to are very concerned about is the straying from constitutional principles and what they see as this government in its amount of expenditure driving us at a quick, fast pace, so to speak, over a fiscal cliff because they see no future. We attended a conference, we had one, a speaker, and he said if you're past 80% GDP, over his research of over 800 years of different governments from all the way back to ancient everything, that government will fail. So yes, we talk about social issues. I've been asked about gay marriage and marijuana. And if I had my druthers, I would tell people, you talk about social issues, keep that. Thank God the First Amendment affords you the right to have all of that discussion. And
people are crying now to move beyond just talk about it. They want to move on it. And the question is, if you're talking with a group of Tea Party, do those issues come up? And at what point collectively, when the Tea Party gets together to have their rallies and their discussions, at what point do they just say, you know what? You may have your strong positions on right to life. You may be anti-gay marriage, but you know what? Put it on the back burner. Because we're not going to discuss those issues here. And Ross Perot taught that in his United We Stand campaign. He didn't want to bring up any social issues at all.
And there are two schools of thought. You talk about it and make it your front issue and lead with your the notion that only by religious virtue you can win and maintain this country, or do you win by keeping quiet about this? I don't know the answer to that, but I would love to hear what Charles has to say.
I would. We're going to have to wait because we're out of time. We're going to have to wait until we come back in April to get the answer to that. But I think one of the other great debates, you know, everybody's been talking about the debate between the Tea Party and the Republican Party and the establishments. The other party is, you've got, the other groups are the libertarians and the religious right. Put all four of them in a room and find out if you can find agreement. That's something we'll try to do. We'll have lots of Sunday nights to discuss that between now and 2016 when the Republicans pick their candidate. But our thanks this evening to Charles Moran, who is chairman of the California Log Cabin Republicans. Charles, thanks very much for being back with us. Karen Siegman has also joined us, also a return visit. She is with Rage Against the Media. Gary Aminoff is a Los Angeles and California Republican political leader and past president of the San Fernando Valley Republican. And thank you very much, Gary, for your maiden voyage, as well as Karen Kenny. And she is with San Fernando Valley Patriots, very active in the Tea Party here in the state of California. This program is a Gen V production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio and Westwood One. Again, our thanks to Ted Woods and James Smith for their assistance in the production of this program. It's been great to be in California. I'm Bruce Dumont, back next week live from Chicago. Until then, Bruce Dumont, good night from Culver City.